The name Urban S. Cobb is sprinkled throughout the Four Rivers like dandelions in spring. It graces the U.S. Highway 45 bridge linking Kentucky and Illinois, a golf tournament, a tugboat, and a type of corncob pipe. Still, the man behind this ubiquitous name is something of a mystery to Western Kentuckians these days. Well, for the first half of the 20th century, Irvin Cobb's name wasn't just all over the Jackson Purchase. It was all over America. Cobb was one of the most published and widely read writers of his time. He was a war correspondent, a playwright, and an actor with a surprising literary legacy. But most importantly, Cobb was a proud Western Kentuckian whose career celebrated the place he called home. I'm Todd Hatton. Over the next hour, we'll meet this unique artist for the first time, or all over again, and discover what he can tell us about ourselves on Irvin S. Cobb, Back Home. This is Irvin S. Cobb, Back Home. I'm Todd Hatton. Years ago, traveling down Broadway in Paducah, Kentucky, you could see an old advertisement painted on the 3rd Street side of one of the buildings, the profile of a big guy smoking a cigar, with Irvin S. Cobb bought all his suits at Wallerstein's written around it. It's 3 blocks up from an old hotel also bearing Cobb's name and smaller versions of the profile at its corners. It's likely that if you had a nickel for each person who's gone up that street and wondered who this Cobb guy was, you could afford to build the Hotel Irvin Cobb all over again. So who was Irvin Cobb? Well, a former colleague of his, Samuel Blythe, introduced him this way at a 1940 political rally.
I present to you one of the most talented and distinguished of our authors, Irvin S. Cobb.
He was indeed a writer, and he was big. Stephen King big, and just as prolific. He was so big that the old radio biography series Our America did an episode about Cobb in the early 50s. No known copy of the broadcast exists, but here's how the show, penned by a young Rod Serling. Yes, the Rod Serling who brought you The Twilight Zone might have sounded when it described Irvin Cobb.
An honest reporter, a hard-working newsman, a talented author, a brilliant humorist, a father and husband, a credit to the nation who now reveres him. So distinctive were his gifts, so alive and bright his personality, it seems this man is still with us, and he probably will remain so. A fixture, a bright fixture, in our America.
In a twist worthy of Serling, that didn't exactly happen. Today there are any number of Cobb's fellow Western Kentuckians who know who he was, but are a little wobbly on what he did, like Anthony Barnes, himself a native Paducan, who I met on Market Street.
One question. Do you know who Irvin S. Cobb is?
Yes.
Can you tell me anything he's written?
No. Oh, wait a minute. Was it Old Judge series? Is that it?
You're getting warm.
I don't remember. I never read anything of his, no.
Sometimes, though, you find someone who knows more than you'd think, someone like Dr. John Luter. I found him in the lobby of the Museum of the American Quilter Society in Paducah.
Currently, I'm living in Paducah, and before that, I lived in New York City for 35 years.
And you've heard of Irvin Cobb?
I have indeed. I heard of him even as a child, because I liked old movies. Will Rogers movies, for instance. He did at least one based on Irvin Cobb's stories. In fact, I just saw it again recently. But anyway, it was something that I knew about.
And you are a rare gem.
Because I know old movies or because I know Irvin Cobb?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's a little complicated. How do you tell a life story that's complex, hair-raising, interesting, funny, sad, and weird all at the same time? You ask for help. It's a little after lunch at Etc. Coffee House in Cobb's hometown of Paducah. I'm meeting 3 librarians, all from the McCracken County Public Library and all passionate about local history. Bobby Wrinkle, Matt Yeager, and Nathan Lynn. And here they come, right on time. We find a quiet corner and settle in. I lay out the problem, and Matt Yeager chimes in first.
Back in his day when articles are written about him, they were looking at his small town roots and finding that part fascinating. But since we all come from a relatively small town, perhaps the real story for Cobb for us in this area is exactly how big his fame got outside of Paducah. And that's the part that I find fascinating, and how big he was in Hollywood and New York. That's the part we've forgotten, I think. And we know that he started at the Sun, the youngest editor in the Sun's history, the youngest managing editor of a paper in the United States at 19 years old. But his legacy as an actor and as a worldwide journalist seems to have been forgotten.
As Matt Yeager finishes, Nathan Lynn nods in agreement.
I think if you were wanting, as part of that, to tell his local side, you could do that through reading parts of his either Judge Priest or Back Home or Sundry accounts. I'm a local historian, so those are what attract me to Cobb, because there's tons of history in them. They tell stories of Paducah and Western Kentucky and the Jackson Purchase, so I think the best way to do it is through talking about his writings or read passages of those writings. Why not use his words to tell it instead of trying to have someone else talk about it?
Fair enough. In describing the Paducah of his 1876 birth in his autobiography, Exit Laughing, Cobb writes,
"By sniffing the air, a blind man could tell where he stood. The almost suffocating rankness of the heavy-fired cured weed as the hands sang at their work in the stemmeries. The lovely savor from stacks of fresh-cut lumber and mountain ranges of moist sawdust along a two-mile stretch of the riverfront. The heavy alcoholic reek of Whiskey Row on Market Street, the all-pervading scent that rose off of wagon yards and mule trading pens. There never was but one Paducah. There never will be but one Paducah."
And Cobb would use that Paducah as a literary setting or as a palette from which he drew his characters. And according to Cobb biographer Dr. Anita Lawson, that's not unlike another Southern writer with connections to the river.
Irvin Cobb liked to say that he was Tom Sawyer. And what that means is that anytime he could get out of school or out of the house, his household was a little tense in those days, he was out on the street running around with other boys. The river was very much a presence in Paducah in those days, more so than now. And so they built rafts and they went everywhere and did everything and had a wonderful time.
And like Tom Sawyer, Cobb seemed to survive and even thrive no matter the odds, thanks to good timing or luck or talent or sometimes all three. Again, Dr. Lawson.
His father died when he was 15. He was all set to go off to military school, and that became impossible. So at age 15, one of the many men who watched out for him as a boy, Joel Shrewsbury, got him a job on the local paper as a reporter, age 15. And of course, first of all, he was reporting on the farmer's market and the price of eggs and things like that. But by the time he was 19, due to a temporary problem, he was managing editor for a while, and of course, being 19, managed to make a huge mess of things and got booted back to being a reporter real fast.
"I was reckless, smart-alecky, careless, a dynamic builder of lurid headlines. I rarely let dull fact hamper my style. My headlining brought down more libel suits than my treatment of the news did."
2 years later, while working as a stringer for the Chicago Tribune, Cobb got an exclusive interview with a fugitive killer from Chicago who'd been captured in Princeton, Kentucky. When Cobb got there, he found out the jailer was ordered to keep strangers out. So how'd he do it? Easy. The jailer had served with his uncle in the Civil War. Cobb got the interview and tied up the telegraph lines between Princeton and Chicago until 2 a.m. His reward? A front-page story in the Tribune, a handwritten note of thanks from the editor, and $100.
"Part of this money went to buy the handsomest box of Superior Mixed Bonbon Chocolates to be had at Gilbert Brothers Drugstore for a young resident of South Georgia who had come up to spend the holidays with two hometown girls."
She was Laura Baker, the daughter of a wealthy Savannah, Georgia family. Elizabeth Cobb Chapman, in her book My Wayward Parent, describes her.
"She was little and dark and pretty and merry and literal-minded and conservative and easily shocked, enthusiastic, very impatient, quicksilver to move, passionately loyal, and about as non-literary as a literate person can be."
And she had the attentions of much better-looking and far better-situated suitors. Years later, when Elizabeth asked her mother why she got engaged to Irvin, Laura said she couldn't remember. "He wanted me to be," she finally said. Irvin didn't have much more to offer her than that. Well, that, two suits, a postage stamp collection, and a weekly salary of $18. She married him anyway in 1898. The same year, Cobb left the Paducah Evening News and went to the Louisville Post. Cobb covered the contentious 1899 Kentucky gubernatorial contest for the Post. Democrat William Goebel lost by a whisker to Republican William Taylor. Goebel's supporters charged fraud, but the Board of Elections certified Taylor anyway. Democrats cried foul, and armed Republicans from eastern Kentucky began showing up in the Capitol. Cobb was a Democrat, but not a Goebel fan.
He was cold and secluded, and aloof, clammy figure, and a malformed one. In repose, he would put you in mind of a coiled snake. In action, of the snake about to strike. And when he did strike, lashing out viciously, you could almost see the venom fly.
Early on January 30th, 1900, Goebel was walking to the statehouse doors when gunfire rang out. A bullet struck Goebel. Cobb ran over and helped carry the wounded man back to his hotel. The Democrats finally overrode the Board of Elections the next day, and Goebel was sworn in as governor. Within 72 hours, he was dead, the first and only U.S. governor to be assassinated.
After he expired, a newspaper proprietor read what he solemnly proclaimed to be the farewell utterance of the deceased. Be brave and fearless and loyal to the great common people. The thing sounded entirely too oratorical for Goebel to have uttered it. This was the actual fact. Shortly before the final coma, Goebel expressed a craving for oysters, his favorite dish. They let him have one. He spit it out and looked up and whispered, "Doc, that was a damn bad oyster."
Cobb biographer and retired Eastern Kentucky University history professor Dr. Bill Ellis says the Goebel assassination was an important stepping stone for Cobb's career.
Well, the Goebel assassination made him regionally famous. And he was very good at writing about, what he saw and what he perceived. In other words, he didn't just write about the trial, but he wrote about the people that were there and what he saw in the streets of Frankfort.
Out of the tragedy, Cobb made an important contact, Goebel aide and Owensboro Messenger co-editor Uri Woodson. Woodson lured Cobb back home in 1901 with a managing editor position at the Paducah News Democrat, a precursor of today's Paducah Sun.
I went back, was to have a child born, to my abiding joy, while having plenty of grief with my job, for we got out 6 weekday numbers and a pretentious Sunday edition and a weekly issue, and I toiled about 18 hours a day, except when I toiled longer. I never fell down, but there were times when literally I went to sleep standing up, and I staggered from fatigue like a drunken man.
Cobb managed to stand it until 1904, when he decided to try his hand at New York journalism. But even with all his experience, the idea made Cobb nervous. Enter Mrs. Laura Cobb. In a 1984 interview, Cobb's granddaughter, Buff, explained.
She had such enormous faith in him. She thought he was the greatest writer that ever lived, the greatest man that ever lived, and he could do anything, and he could conquer all worlds. So she said, "Listen, where's the biggest city in the world? It's New York City, and if you're going to move to a paper, it's going to be New York." So he said, "Well, how can I do it? You're just going to have a baby, and my mother, and my sister, and my younger brother, dad, you know, the whole family thing." She said, I'll write my father. And he subsidized Irvin, gave him $200 to go to New York, and she went home to Savannah with the baby, who was just a few months old.
As it turns out, Cobb needn't have worried about his home life. In 1942, Buff's mother, Elizabeth, now an author in her own right, appeared on the Mary Margaret McBride radio program. McBride asked her about the family dynamic.
Was he a disciplinarian?
No, he's an angel. I'm the worst spoiled brat in the world.
You are?
Yes.
He had everything he wanted?
Yes, because every time anybody ever did try to discipline me, my mother, he got so indignant with him. He's an old softy.
He is?
Yes. He's an angel.
I can tell that you and he have been very close. I think that's lovely when a father and daughter are very close.
We're awfully alike, I think. We look alike and we think alike. I don't think as quick and as hard and as fast, but I tramp along behind him. Mm-hmm. Same footprints, anyhow.
Tell them what a friend said describing the Cobb family.
Oh, it was a friend of mine who was describing us to somebody who didn't know us. And he said, "Well, I'll make a little parable about the Cobbs. If they were broken down on a mountain road in the middle of the night, the tire had blown out, Mr. Cobb would get out in the road and roar. And Elizabeth would sit in the back of the car and think of something else, and Mrs. Cobb would change the tire."
During a daring display, and while I went out for some peanuts and a program, the dirty dog stole her away. Oh, yes, oh yes. So tonight I will have my revenge.
The old softy hits the Big Apple, and the apple hits back when Irvin S. Cobb, back home, returns.
With one mighty swipe, I will dislocate his belly jaw. I'll catch the old blighter, I will. And when I catch him, the blighter I'll kill. He shall die. He shall die. He shall die for the ice.
This is Irvin S. Cobb, back home. I'm Todd Hatton. Irvin Cobb arrived in New York in August of 1904. He made a circuit of the city papers, then another one, and then another. Each time they told him thanks, but no thanks. 2 weeks later, Cobb met up with his friend and former boss, Uri Woodson, who was in New York on political business. Woodson later said the young man looked despondent, discouraged, and a little shabby. He gave Cobb a good drink of bourbon and a shot of encouragement. Cobb's granddaughter Buff describes what happened after Irvin and Woodson parted.
It seems he went out to the park, and he sat down, being very discouraged about the whole thing, and he told me it was the only honest-to-God, real, true inspiration he ever had in his life.
Better let Irvin tell the rest.
It lifted me off that bench as if I had been bee-stung. In half an hour, I was in my hall bedroom composing a form letter. I wound up like this. This is positively your last chance. I have grown weary of studying the wallpaper designs in your anteroom. A modest appreciation of my own worth forbids my doing business with your head office boy any longer. Unless you employ me right away, I shall go elsewhere and leave your paper flat on its back right in the middle of a hard summer, and your whole life hereafter will be one vast surging regret.
Cobb had 13 copies made on gilt-edged paper, then sent them to 13 different managing editors. Then he went back to his boarding house room and went to bed. The next morning, his first victim was the managing editor of the New York Sun.
He was holding my card in one hand and one of my letters in the other. "Are you the same man who wrote this damn fool letter?" he asked. I said I was. "Well," he said, "I happen to be acting managing editor today. If you've got half as much ability as you've got gall, consider yourself hired." "All right," I said, "I'm hired."
Cobb worked for the Sun for a year and a half, covering the 1905 Portsmouth Peace Conference that ended the Russo-Japanese War. Information on the negotiations was sparse, so Cobb filled his columns describing the exotic Japanese and Russian delegates. He called the articles inconsequential, but they got him noticed and nationally syndicated. He departed the Sun for a well-paying job at Joseph Pulitzer's Evening World, and Cobb biographer Dr. William Ellis says the size of Irvin's paycheck was a deeply ingrained compulsion.
He really suffered from what today we'd call a sense of anxiety. He came from very poor circumstances. When he went to work in 1896, he had to make enough income for not only himself, but his mother and his two sisters. And then when he married and had a child, he was earning an income or trying to earn enough money to provide for all these people. So his anxiety was that he didn't have anything really backing him up as far as family wealth was concerned. And he was always looking for a way to make money. And he made a lot of money. Probably in 1907, he made more money than any other newspaper man in New York City. He probably made $1,000 a month in 1907. Today that would translate into quite a bit of money every year.
When Irvin Cobb penned the first Judge Priest story in 1912, he was pulling down $20,000 a year writing for the Saturday Evening Post. He'd come over full-time the year before. Adjusted for the 21st century, that's about $500,000, making him not just the highest-paid journalist in New York, but in the country. Then, on June 28, 1914, a young Bosnian shot the Austro-Hungarian Archduke and his wife.
It's a long way to Tipperary.
Those bullets sparked off a war that would change the world, and Cobb along with it.
It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
World War I began in earnest when Germany invaded Belgium on August 4, 1914. That same day, Irvin Cobb got a telegram from Saturday Evening Post editor George Lorimer. "Seems like this here war is done busted right in our face," he wrote. "Your ship sails Thursday." Cobb departed for Europe with $6,000 in gold sovereigns and a gun. Within 3 weeks, Cobb was a guest of the Kaiser in German-occupied Belgium. Cobb finagled access to the front from the German high command and a line of communication back to the post. Dr. Anita Lawson says as Cobb's articles came out and were later published together as Paths of Glory, they made an impact.
It's hard to believe now that how many Americans first read a lot about World War I in the Saturday Evening Post. To us, with 24/7 newscast, it's just hard to believe how different war reporting was then. And even when he and the couple of other journalists who were with him and reported back from Belgium on the German army by sending cables through England, I mean, even that was different and new and exciting.
Would it be fair to say that later books about war reporting, even Ernie Pyle's work or Michael Harris about the Vietnam War, are they literary, well, genre descendants of Paths of Glory, do you think?
I think so. Now, he wasn't the only one, but he developed, I think, a new kind of war writing. He wrote about the pain that it was caused. He called Belgium a rag doll. He was horrified by the suffering that he saw. Other journalists, they weren't writing about the same kinds of things that Irvin Cobb was. And so reading Irvin Cobb in the Saturday Evening Post, both his early journey, but much later when the United States was in the war and when he went back, that was when Americans first realized the extent and the horror of the war that was going on in Europe.
Dr. William Ellis.
He described the long lines of refugees, the soldiers that he came in contact with, the Belgian soldiers, the Germans. He described the German soldiers as being very well-trained and focused on exactly what they were doing. One of the descriptions was of a Belgian fort that had just been completely demolished. And he was taken, along with some other reporters, up to that fort. And he described the odor. Hundreds of men had been buried in this devastated fort. But he said, once you get this odor in your nose, you'll remember that as long as you have a nose.
4 months after Cobb's return, Paths of Glory came out in the U.S. and Great Britain. The critics raved. Cobb toured the U.S. lecturing on his experiences, ending in Paducah in mid-April 1915. The crowds got bigger and bigger at each stop. The reviews, better and better. Composer G.E. Holmes was even moved to write the piece you're hearing right now. It's called, appropriately enough, The War Correspondent, and he dedicated it to Cobb. At the end of April, Cobb was honored at a dinner at New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The people who planned it were a who's who of the time: Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks Sr., and Irving Berlin. Guests were presented with a souvenir book of tributes to Irvin. One of them came from his publisher's editorial assistant, the soon-to-be novelist Sinclair Lewis. Lewis was in awe of Cobb, going beyond the older writer's latest work to praise his fiction as well.
Cobb has made Paducah and all the other Paducahs in Kentucky and Minnesota and California and Vermont, from which the rest of us came, live for us in fiction, which gets us as no foreign tale ever can. He makes one smell the soil, a thing that has been said of him so often, it is a platitude.
Cobb wanted to return to Europe right away, but a hernia changed those plans. He'd gotten it in Europe helping move German wounded on the front. Instead, Cobb went to the hospital. It was a long recovery, but Dr. William Ellis says Cobb put the time on his back to good use. He wrote a book.
Speaking of Operations, which was probably his first big popular book, it sold over a million copies. He got involved with a new press in New York City, George Doran. And he and Doran became very good friends, and Doran published most of his books into the late 1920s. Cobb was a cash cow for Doran. Almost anything that was published for almost 20 years was a bestseller. And many of these things were rewritten. They were given new titles, and yet they still made a lot of money. And Cobb did make quite a bit of money, but he also spent a lot of money.
In Speaking of Operations, which would eventually be translated into 8 languages and Braille, Cobb describes the inhabitants of the operating room he's just been wheeled into.
From his attire and general deportment, I judged that Dr. Z was going to be the master of the revels, he being attired appropriately in a white domino with rubber gloves and a fancy cap. There were present, also, my diagnostic friend Dr. X, likewise in a fancy dress costume, and a surgeon I had never met. From what I could gather, he was going over the course behind Dr. Z to replace the divot.
A new medium caught Cobb's attention in 1915, the moving picture. He appeared in his first movie while on his Paths of Glory lecture tour, playing an American tourist in Cecil B. DeMille's The Arab. In late 1916, the first feature-length film he wrote entirely, The Dollar and the Law, came out, but the conflict Cobb thought he'd left back in Europe made its way across the Atlantic, so he went back to the front, covering the war again until June. After the war and into the 1920s, Cobb was speaking more and working more in the movies. He wrote just as much, and the public couldn't get enough. Then there was Prohibition. Cobb hated it. He loved his julep, and he took every opportunity to blast the law that kept them apart. But while lamenting the lack of legal liquor, he couldn't complain financially. On Monday, October 28th, 1929, he was almost a millionaire. Then came Black Tuesday. The stock market crashed, and the roaring 20s fell silent. Cobb didn't lose everything, but the retirement he'd planned was now impossible. Elizabeth Cobb wrote about her father's gloom.
He and I were taking a walk together. The last mile, that's what we felt that promenade to be, a doomed processional. The day before, he had heard of the failure of the great investment house of Goldman Sachs. He walked silently for many miles. Finally, he turned to me and said, "Well, this year I pay no income tax. Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Thank you, Mr. Sachs."
As the economy cooled, so too did the reading public to Cobb's fiction. Two mysteries, including Judge Priest Turns Detective, sold poorly, and he stopped writing fiction altogether in 1936. He did have a turn on the radio, though, hosting a program called Paducah Plantation for 6 months in 1935. And there were always the movies, 11 of them between 1932 and 1938. His two favorites were one where he played the heavy, and the other, well, he wasn't in that one at all.
Court's call to order.
1934's Judge Priest was directed by the legendary John Ford and starred Cobb's best friend, Will Rogers.
Steamboat round the bend!
Hey, that's a river talk, steamboat round the bend.
Steamboat round the bend!
And with Duke as a pilot, I'll bet you could win it again.
I suppose you'd like to bet your boat against my boat on the result of that race, huh? You made yourself a bet and lost yourself a steamboat.
Ford directed them both in 1935 Steamboat Round the Bend. Cobb's granddaughter, Buff, said they had a ball. John Ford, not so much.
The two of them just absolutely drove the director crazy because they ad-libbed everything.
"Gentlemen," said Ford, with just a whiff of sarcasm, "I don't suppose either of you has gone as far as to read the script for this production." "Who, me?" said Will, in pretended surprise. "When did I ever read one of those fool things?" "How about you, Mr. Cobb?" inquired Ford. "Oh, I took one glance at it," I said, "and then I quit. I could write a better script than that with one hand and Eugene O'Neill tied behind my back."
Earlier in 1935, Cobb succeeded Rogers as host of the Academy Awards. He handed out Oscars to director Frank Capra for It Happened One Night, and to the movie stars Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. Irvin even presented a special juvenile Oscar to Shirley Temple.
Hollywood, that pony super coney Hollywood. They come from Chillicothe's and Paducah's with their bazookas.
The waning years of the 1930s were a time of marked change for the world and for Irvin Cobb. And as Dr. William Ellis says, it wasn't necessarily for the better.
Cobb liked the what you call the Hollywood scene of the 1930s. And what happened eventually, though, after 1935 is that the only type of part that he could get in movies was kind of a bit part instead of a starring role as he'd had in Steamboat Round the Bend.
Steamboat Round the Bend would be bittersweet for Irvin. After filming wrapped, Rogers joined pilot Wiley Post for a flight into Alaska. In a 1961 documentary about Will Rogers, Cobb's former grandson-in-law, Mike Wallace, explains the tragedy that unfolded.
August 15, 1935.
Will and Wiley Post take off from Fairbanks, Alaska, bound for Point Barrow, northernmost city on the American continent. They are due at Point Barrow, their plane is discovered a twisted wreck. Both Wiley Post and Will Rogers are dead.
Cobb wrote a tribute to his friend that appeared in papers across the nation. He ends it with this story. On the last day of shooting for Steamboat, Cobb found Rogers sitting in his car by the soundstage. Will invited Irvin out to his ranch. Cobb bowed out, knowing Rogers preferred his corrals to shepherding a tenderfoot through the bush. Rogers insisted. "Better change your mind, old-timer," he said. "This picture's done, and I'm fixing to go away, and we may not get together for quite a spell."
"Quite a spell it will be, for it's forevermore, I guess. So I'll remember him that way, or at least I'll try to. Sitting all hunched up in his car, waving his hand to me and grinning that grin, almost the only man I ever knew who went plumb to the top and yet never used the necks of his friends for the rounds of the ladder he climbed on."
The sentiment Cobb expressed about his friend was the polar opposite of his opinion of another iconic figure of the time, Franklin D. Roosevelt. Irvin was a lifelong Democrat, but a third FDR term crossed a line. He stumped for Republican Wendell Willkie in 1940, even giving a speech on the radio 4 days before Election Day.
"There are countless reasons why I'm against the perpetuation of the political theory of the double deal. In fact, I counted up to the first 500,000, and then I got tired and stopped. But I included the boondoogling, which wasted billions upon vain projects and abandoned experiments. His greed for authority and yet more authority and then some authority. His open assault upon the highest judiciary of the land when he undertook to turn that bench into a minstrel first part of pliant for... yes, man."
Dr. Bill Ellis says external factors weren't the only reason Cobb became more caustic.
In his later life, he was ill. He'd had to have a second operation. Gastric operation. He eventually developed more and more health problems, and I think that had a lot to do with his, really the beginning of his lack of humor, and he became less humorous in his later years.
Irvin Cobb's autobiography, Exit Laughing, was published to critical acclaim in March 1941, but it was a rare bright spot. Japan's attack at Pearl Harbor drug his country into war that December, and his column, syndicated for 20 years, was canceled in 1942. Cobb's health did improve enough the same year for a family trip to New Mexico. His wife and daughter went to New York afterwards. He went back to California. Then after a sudden, severe illness which sent him to the hospital, Irvin joined his family in Manhattan. Elizabeth Cobb later wrote of his appearance when she picked him up at the train station.
"For a moment, we did not recognize him. This bent old man, this slow-moving, stooped, shambling, thin old man. When I reached him, he took my arm and leaned hard on it. 'Dad,' I asked, 'you don't look to me as though you ought to be walking.' 'It is a little difficult,' he told me. We took him home and put him to bed. He never got up again."
But he would keep writing. He had written every day for 50 years and would do so right up until March 10, 1944, when he, as Elizabeth would later report, slid into a coma and from it out of life. Cobb's complex life leaves complicated questions. Just what is his place in the literary canon, and how did he manage to creep out the masters of modern horror? We'll have the answers when Irvin S. Cobb Back Home returns. You're listening to Irvin S. Cobb Back Home. I'm Todd Hatton. In the 7 decades since Irvin Cobb's ashes were laid in his beloved West Kentucky soil, his memory seems to have cooled. Why that is one of the concerns I put to McCracken County librarians Bobby Wrinkle, Matt Yeager, and Nathan Lynn. Remember them? When we met up at Et Cetera Coffee House, as we spoke, Bobby Wrinkle put her finger right on it.
Could it be, though, that people just don't know the depth of what he's done? I mean, if you polled a lot of people, a lot of us that are interested in Paducah, Kentucky, history, literature, things like that, we know who Cobb is. But if you just polled a lot of people, they wouldn't be sure, oh, he wrote some books, he was from Paducah, but would they know the depth? Would they know what all he's done?
From the people we spoke to in the streets of Paducah at the start of the program, the answer to that question is a very shaky maybe. But what about today's generation? We sent Rob Canning to the Murray State University campus to find out.
Wesley, and I'm a junior.
Where are you from originally?
Paducah.
Okay. Oh, okay. So have you ever heard the author Irvin Cobb?
Yeah.
Yeah? What do you know about him?
Nothing, but I've heard of him.
But you know he was a writer?
Yeah.
You ever seen any of his books or anything like that, anything he's ever written?
I have not, but he has a road in Paducah, Irvin Cobb Drive.
Elliot Akins, I'm a senior.
And where are you from originally?
I am from Marshall County.
Marshall County, okay. So have you ever heard of the author Irvin Cobb?
Never heard of him before.
No? So you don't know he's one of the most famous authors of the 20th century, and he's from Paducah?
Never heard of him before.
Kaya Young, and I'm a junior.
And where are you from originally?
Paducah, Kentucky.
We're doing a documentary on the author Irvin Cobb. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes, I have.
What do you know about him?
That his name's Irvin Cobb.
He's a writer?
Yep.
Know anything else about him?
Not much.
My name is Jacob Speck. Pretty good looking fella. I'm a sophomore.
All right. What's your major and where are you from originally?
Ag business, and I'm originally from Logan County.
Okay.
It's in Kentucky.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of the author Irvin Cobb?
Irvin Cobb. I've heard Cobb, the name, before.
You've heard Irvin Cobb before.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a road in Paducah. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, Cobb Road.
So that's what you know.
All right.
Fear not, there is still hope. Writers across the country have found Cobb's work, in particular his grim stories, to be fertile ground. One of them is Michael Price. He's a journalist, author, illustrator, historian, playwright, and musician. Speaking to him from his Fort Worth home, I asked him how a Texan managed to come across a writer whose works are obscure even in his Kentucky hometown.
Early on, oh, this would have to be childhood discovery of a paperback book collecting stories by H.P. Lovecraft. One thing led to another, became fascinated with Lovecraft, who was the 20th century's answer to Edgar Allan Poe, and eventually that trail led to a book that Lovecraft had written in installments during the 1920s called Supernatural Horror and Literature. The book in turn cited many examples of what would amount to Lovecraft's greatest influences. Among those he cited was a story called Fishhead by Irvin S. Cobb.
In 1995, he set about producing a graphic novel adaptation of Fishhead, the tale of an unusual man living along the shores of Reelfoot Lake and his bond with the lake's aquatic residents. It was published in 2011. When the young Michael Price first found the short story, it was fascination at first read. I ask him why, and he doesn't tell me. He shows me. This is Price reading from Cobb's description of Reelfoot Lake.
Reelfoot is and has always been a lake of mystery. In places, it is bottomless. Other places, the skeletons of the cypress trees that went down when the earth sank still stand upright, so that if the sun shines from the right quarter and the water is less muddy than common, a man peering face downward into its depths sees, or thinks he sees, down below him the bare top limbs upstretching like drowned men's fingers, all coated with the mud of years and bandaged with pennons of the green lake slime. Quite a setting of the stage, huh?
As he read, I was almost swatting mosquitoes, if that's an answer.
You can see it.
Yes, indeed. Like you can almost see the muddy Mississippi of Huckleberry Finn. Earlier in the program, Dr. Anita Lawson spoke of Cobb's comparison to Mark Twain. I asked Price if he thinks they've got anything in common.
I think they share an understanding of the human condition, that is, the tragedy, the hilarity, the futility, the urge to strive against one's circumstances. You find that in both writers. You find perhaps a comparable level of the ability to generate suspense and even terror in Twain and Cobb. The cave sequence in Tom Sawyer, for example, is a hair raiser.
Okay, but is there a direct connection? Maybe Cobb's Judge Priest is somehow, some way, Twain's Tom Sawyer, all grown up and a member of the bar.
A wish dream fulfillment of Twain himself and Cobb himself. I don't show any written record that would link Cobb to Twain in terms of conscious influence, but it's inescapable. That really powerful story, The Escape of Mr. Trim, is at once a Mark Twain-style shaggy dog story and a thrilling tale of the degeneration of a perfectly respectable middle-class human being.
If we want to talk about direct connection, then it's back to supernatural horror in literature and its author, H.P. Lovecraft. So, I call Lovecraft biographer and scholar, S.T. Joshi.
Hello.
Mr. Joshi?
Yes, hi.
Joshi is the author of several books about Lovecraft's works and wrote the definitive Lovecraft biography, I Am Providence. So my first question is, how did H.P. Lovecraft come across Cobb's work, and what was his reaction?
Well, I'll tell you, it's quite surprising. Most people know that Lovecraft really liked that story, Fishhead, which was first published, I think, in the Argosy sometime in 1911. What people may not know is that Lovecraft actually wrote a letter to the editor of the Argosy, you know, a month or two after the story came out, praising the story. I'll just read you a very quick letter. It's very short. It says February 8th of 1913. And he says, "It is the belief of the writer that very few short stories of equal merit have been published anywhere during recent years. It is easy to imagine with what genuine regret the editors to whom it was submitted declined to print it." So as early as 1913, Lovecraft was said, "Wow, this is a really good story."
I'm curious to know what you think that Lovecraft was responding to in Cobb's works.
You know, Fishhead, I think the idea of hybrid entities is something that had long fascinated Lovecraft. And, you know, a number of other stories in Lovecraft's work talk about miscegenation, talk about interbreeding between humans and other entities. So this is a theme that Lovecraft sort of really obsessed him. And when he saw it expressed, you know, quite well in Cobb's story, I mean, that it's a classic horror story now, Fishhead is, I'm sure he latched onto it.
And Lovecraft would recommend it to his circle of fellow writers, including a kid from Chicago named Robert Bloch.
Oh, yes, Robert Bloch.
Bloch became a prolific author of horror and science fiction. He wrote screenplays for Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Good evening.
Rod Serling's Night Gallery.
Offered to you now 6 feet of earth and all that it contains. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Night Gallery.
I Spy. And Star Trek.
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
Bloch and Michael Price became friends in the late 70s, and one day Bloch asked Price if he'd ever heard of Irvin Cobb's Fishhead. He told Price if it was good enough for Lovecraft to single out as a, quote, nightmare on paper, then he was willing to tear into it, which he did. He said, "Changed my entire direction," that one story did. Price elaborates.
The story Fishhead showed Robert Bloch that it was not only possible but also desirable to channel indigenous folklore, specifically Southern American folklore, into effective fiction. And of course, Bloch's stories evolved over the long term into big shaggy dog stories, elaborate narratives in search of a single punchline. Bloch was doing this as early as his contributions to Weird Tales as a youngster. And of course, Bloch remained consistent into the mid-century until the point where he became enchanted with psychological thrillers and, of course, as a consequence, wrote Psycho.
Wait a minute. Did Price just say what I think he said? Is there a connection from Irvin Cobb to Norman Bates?
I think we wouldn't have had Psycho, that, of course, became probably Alfred Hitchcock's most effective motion picture, had Robert Bloch, as a teenager, been influenced to seek out these deeper currents of folklore, then fold them into his attempts at writing commercial fiction.
Wow. I tried this out on my trio of librarians back at Etc., Instead of Kevin Bacon, it's 6 Degrees of Irvin Cobb.
I only know one Janet Leigh movie. That's the problem. Psycho, right?
Or does it go from her dad to Tony Curtis? Or does it go from... Or Janet Leigh goes from...
Well, when you give up, I'll tell you.
All right, good. You do it.
After a few minutes, they throw in the towel. So, here it is. Cobb publishes Fishhead in 1911. H.P. Lovecraft...
In his house at Rillia, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming.
Reads it, and later recommends it to Robert Bloch in the 30s.
That's a rather nasty idea.
As Bloch later told Michael Price, it changed the direction of his writing. In 1959, Bloch publishes Psycho.
The whole place was, well, it's too horrible to describe.
That same year, Alfred Hitchcock makes a movie out of it, shooting the legendary shower scene with Janet Leigh that December. As a result... Janet Leigh later says...
I still don't take showers. That's the truth.
All so, thanks to Irvin Cobb.
Irvin Cobb is responsible for a very dirty Janet Leigh.
The current impact, that's amazing.
Well, the impact he could have just on Lovecraft fans, you know. if you got on the Lovecraft blogs, yeah. Well,
as Bobby Wrinkle pointed out, there's a current impact. But that may not be enough to spark a Cobb renaissance. Michael Price provides a necessary ingredient.
Curiosity is a great factor. Once you get people wondering who that guy was whose name appears on that street sign, why do we remember this figure in monumental landmarks, but most people still have no idea who he was or is? I mean, he lives through his writings, but the writings lie dormant. I never for a moment entertained the hope that our graphic novel adaptation of Fishhead would become any kind of bestseller. It was strictly a labor of love.
That's as may be, but Price might be onto something, and Matt Yeager is thinking along those same lines.
If you want to sell something old, you got to repackage it. I think the best way to sell Cobb to a new audience would be for a few people who know Cobb, know his work, not just his fiction, but some of his stories and some of his news work and that kind of thing, to compile a new anthology that has a slick cover of his best stories, of his best news stories, with some fun photographs. Instead of the old dusty cloth-covered brittle-paged books that are on the shelf as special collections that you have to read at the library.
And S.T. Joshi has a similar idea.
I read a lot of Cobb's fiction, and in fact, I hope one day to publish a sort of a slim collection of Cobb's weird work. There are about, I would say, half a dozen stories of Cobb's that could be considered weird, horrific, supernatural, amidst, as you know, a mass of other stories that are, you know, generally humorous or of other sorts.
It may be that any one of those compilations of Irvin Cobb's works would find eager readers today, speaking as they do to that sense of place he so treasured, as well as to the people who have lived, lost, and loved there since Andrew Jackson purchased the purchase. And if that was all the legacy Cobb left us, that'd be enough. But Dr. Bill Ellis says there's more.
He could be celebrated if for no other reason than he was a great reporter. Certainly one of the great journalists of all time. He was a really good writer of magazine articles. His short stories, especially the so-called Grimm Tales, they're fascinating. There's a book called Cobb's Cavalcade that came out in 1946, which contains all of the Grimm Tales as well as several of the Judge Priest stories. I mean, these are great stories.
Dr. Anita Lawson.
I don't know that he will be around a long time, except as that kind of a footnote. He's a very interesting man. It may be that what he did for war reporting will last as long as anything else. Although I notice that there's still lots of his books for sale. In fact, they've put some of them on Nook, and they're actually charging for a few of them.
Michael Price.
He was a determined cuss, and his work shows he was filled with the humors of life, eager to share them, not really caring whether or not he changed anyone's thinking, as long as he shared with them the enthusiasm that he felt.
And there it rests, as Irvin Shrewsbury Cobb himself rests by a granite boulder in Paducah's Oak Grove Cemetery. At his request, the spot where his ashes lie is marked by a dogwood tree, as much a symbol of his hometown as Cobb once was, and perhaps will one day be again. I think that would make him smile. Irvin S. Cobb Back Home is a production of WKMS News, written and produced by Todd Hatton, Chad Lampe, and Rob Canning. We're much obliged to Bobby Wrinkle, Matt Yeager, and Nathan Lynn of the McCracken County Public Library. We also thank Dr. Anita Lawson, Dr. Bill Ellis, Michael Price, S.T. Joshi, Tom Butler Jr., West Kentucky Community and Technical College, and Murray State University Libraries. And we thank the Library of Congress, WKAR, Michigan State Public Radio, KASU Arkansas State, WFDD Wake Forest, and WEKU Eastern Kentucky University. And of course, we thank Kayla Dunn, David Weatherly, Mike Brewer, Alan Rhodes, and Etc. Coffee House in Cobb's Fair Paducah. I've been your host, Todd Hatton. Thanks for listening.